Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Dark Reading Radio. I'm Sarah Peters, Senior Editor here at Dark Reading, and we thank you for joining us on today's episode, which we have very simply dubbed Understanding Cybercrime, something that, with all of our collected years of experience in security, we still often struggle to do. Our host for today's episode is our brave and fearless leader, Editor-in-Chief Tim Wilson. I'm going to shortly turn it over to him, but before I do, I want to remind those of you in the audience today that if you are listening to us live, you can participate in the text chat that is happening alongside the show. Just type right into the window beneath the radio, the media player. We will be on the audio for about 30 minutes, and then our speakers will be joining you there. At the bottom of that 30 minutes, you can ask them your questions directly. In the meantime, don't be shy. Talk to each other. There's nice people there. Until then, I'm going to pass it back over to Tim Wilson. Tim, on to you.
Thanks, Sarah. We're excited today to have with us Dr. Shane Shook. He is an independent expert and affiliate expert witness of the Bates Group, but he has done a good deal of work, including court testimony and research on cybercrime across the industry. One of the things that we hear a lot from our readers, the security professionals who read Dark Reading, is, you know, who are these bad guys and why is it they're doing what they're doing? And I'm hoping that, you know, we can get Shane to talk a little bit about that. Before we sort of launch into the questions, though, Shane, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do and you know, how you look at the cybercrime issue?
Certainly. Thanks. And good morning or good afternoon, good evening to everyone. So as you mentioned, I'm an independent expert affiliated with Bates Group, who are located in Portland, Oregon. But I also affiliate with a number of other organizations, including some that I serve as advisor to their boards, including Cylance and Packet Sled and some others. In terms of what I do, I spend about half of my time doing fraud investigations, primarily in financial services, fundamentally in the exchange-traded markets, as well as some over-the-counter. And then, not coincidentally, I spend the other half of my time doing cyber breach investigations and advisory support for primarily banking and insurance and other financial services companies, as well as some other sectors, with regard to attempts to access their intellectual property or their customer accounts or other competitive information that can assist cyber criminals in achieving the varied objectives that they have.
That sounds like fascinating work. We wrestle all the time with, you know, various threat actors in this space. You know, for years we focused mostly on criminals and more recently organized crime, with regard to, you know, just sort of direct funds transfer attacks and you know, attempts to steal, you know, financially valuable information, that sort of thing. And then we went through a period where we were talking a lot about hacktivists and anonymous and people who are more motivated politically. And then recently it's all been about state-sponsored attacks and China and Russia and all of those things. I'm wondering, you know, as you deal with this stuff sort of in real life, you know, what kinds of threats are you seeing out there, and who are the threat actors that you deal with most commonly?
Well, it's interesting. You hit on some key topics there, and I've been involved in a number of the or most of the notorious investigations that you can read about. But the reality is that perception guides awareness, and awareness attention. And the current attention on the, quote, state sponsorship is really fairly illogical, given that the majority of the actual targeted attacks and real organized cybercrime activities are focused more specifically on financial services hacking to gain competitive advantage against primarily the markets today rather than consumers, but also to still have that tail drag of, as we've seen over the past 15 to 20 years, targeting consumers to steal from grandma and grandpa's checkbook or their online trading accounts or what have you. But really, those types of attacks dedicated toward disruption or manipulation of the markets through theft and fraud are much more significant and much more common today, whether it's against exchanges or banks or corporations or individual consumers. They're much more common than these, quote, state-sponsored activities that get quite a lot of attention, particularly in this political season.
Yeah, absolutely. It helps sort of bring us back to reality a little bit. You know, as a CISO or a chief security officer in a financial services firm, how should they divide their time, you know, based on what you see, you know, in terms of, do you see most of the breaches that you deal with coming through, targeted malware, or are they very specifically, developed hacks that are delivered to a very specific company, or what kinds of sort of entry points do you see coming from the attackers?
That's a great question, and it sets the stage for, nearly every conversation I have, whether it's with courts to explain what's happened or with customers to do risk assessments or breach assessments. Effectively, it depends on what the objective of the attack is. The objective of the attack and the risk sensitivity that objective has at a point in time will determine the CISO's priority for handling it. So, for example, quite commonly, tax season is a heightened risk time frame for targeted attacks against corporate financials or, coincidentally, against intellectual property, such as corporate performance, financial performance, or planning projections, et cetera, that boards will rely on. And so CISOs have begun, I don't think they yet fully comprehend the opportunity of the risk to appreciate what the impact might be, but they've begun to recognize threats against their corporate financial systems or their corporate performance data and key reporting metrics data in, for example, the tax season or at least the annual shareholder meeting preparation as being the most sensitive to them in the private industry space. In public supporting industry like defense contractors and such, and the public services organizations as governments are, the time frames differ and the objectives differ. Currently, we're seeing a lot of attention and a lot of determined efforts to attack the political system, to sway public opinion, to attempt to interrupt the services season, if you will. And so CISOs of those types of organizations, of course, are focused more on the services and preventing the interruption or the manipulation of those services that attackers are currently pursuing in their objectives and their efforts. So largely it depends on whether it's public or private institutions, and increasingly CISOs are becoming aware that the risk sensitivity to the target objective is what really defines the concern that they have to operate with. as they interact with their peers at the C-suite and serve their shareholders and customers.
Okay. So I think one of the things that we wrestle with a little bit is as, you know, security professionals, we sometimes think of a targeted attack coming from a single individual or a single group of individuals, but in reality, a lot of these attacks are sort of hired out, aren't they? I mean, there's someone who wants to make the attack, and then they may bring in others who are specialists to help them out. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how the threat is sort of built and how the threat actors sort of work together?
Certainly, there's been a growing recognition of something that I and others like Brian Krebs and Harlan Carvey and others have talked about for the past 5 or 6 years of the cybercrime as a service, if you will, economy, the service economy that supports cybercrimes. And currently, I spend a lot of time, particularly in the private sector, I'm sorry, the public sector, with government organizations, describing what I call the third wave, which, if we talk about the evolution of cyber threats as they've become the cybercrime economy, the first wave was what we used to see in the 1998 to, say, 2005, maybe beyond, efforts of individuals to effectively disrupt or test defenses with script kiddie attacks, SQL injection, cross-site scripting, interruption attacks from a single point of presence like a denial of service, et cetera. And we call that, or I refer to that as first wave, because that's where technology was the target, or interrupting a business or testing its defenses to gain entry was the target that an individual was pursuing. Then we moved into the what I call the second wave, which is where we began to see the concept of APT emerge, with people like Kevin Mandia popularizing that concept and a whole industry effectively growing around the detection and prevention of APT activities. Not APT tools specifically, although that's what many of the solutions focus on, but the activities that represent the advanced persistent threats. And that's where technology became a tool for gaining access. But coincidentally, in that second wave, we saw a lot of those independent script kiddies beginning to organize through the experience that they had in communities in the dark web that was emerging, as well as combining their talents and offering their services to each other in ways that would create an economy of scale and effort. And then beginning in 2012, 13 or thereabout, we began to see what I call third wave, which is what we're currently in, where objectives were being forward planned for achievement. An organization was being constructed, whether it be by hacktivists like Anonymous and LawSec and that, or by organized criminal elements, or perhaps state-sponsored organizations, which in some cases are not necessarily segregated from the other two. It depends on the nature of the relationships. But in this third wave, we began to see real planning, real organization, and with that, the growth of this service economy that we call the cybercrime as a service, where particular talents are heralded and even marketed and shared through subscription and coincidental service offerings, so that today the real threat that we see around cybercrime is things like the SWIFT attacks or the Carbon Act gang attacks, as they're called, against the varied international money transfer networks or ATM networks or et cetera, where the actual perpetrators of these crimes may not even be hackers of our attention and our focus of the past 20 years, but today they might actually be economists that work in rogue trading firms in other areas of the world or even here in the U.S., or they might be bankers at some level of an organization that decide that they want to pursue benefits of dark money by hiring out the talent from the underground that they need to do the technical efforts to achieve the procedural results of hacking a bank network rather than robbing a bank directly. So the evolution has changed the way that hackers operate, whereas, you know, 1998 to 2005-ish, we saw the independent hackers creating names for themselves. Then after 2005, we began to see them organizing and conducting advanced persistent threat activities, largely supported with constructive malware and beginning to really focus on exploiting zero days or single days or other things that we talk about. But today, and for the past at least 3 years, what we've been faced with now are smarter adversaries with procedural understanding of the targets and recognition of the benefit of hiring other smart people to focus on their talents.
You know, what you're saying is fascinating because it creates a new way of thinking about security in the sense that, you know, as you pointed out, most of the technology and a lot of the best practices that we've been using in IT security for decades has been around the technology used by the attacker or the methods and, you know, signatures used by the attacker. But what you just described is an environment in which the folks that do the hiring, the people who are motivated to get the information, are a completely different group from the people who actually perpetrate the technical part of the attack. How do you see that playing on the defense side? You know, does that change the way we should think about how we defend ourselves against attack?
Yes and no. Let's say this. At first, there's got to be some fundamental understanding. So in that second wave, as I talked about, the organization that emerged by hackers participating with each other in campaigns and activities that we called APT, we began to see the growth and the spread of botnets. And today, and so those botnets have been tended and grown over the past decade or more. And today, it's estimated that as much as 70% of the global botnets, of course by different stripes and sponsorship, as much as 70% of them are behind corporate firewalls. And I use the word corporate both in public and private industry concepts. And what that means is that there are insiders in nearly every organization, whether it's public or private. And that's not saying an insider employee as much as insider access through unprotected RDP or unprotected VPN access or employees succumbing to phishing and whaling and other types of targeted social engineering attacks. But what it means is that there are methods of gaining access that exist in many, if not most, organizations today. And those accesses are the fundamental offering of this cybercrime as a service economy. It's the ability to market what hosts in what groups with what types of access these botmasters have in the underground that facilitates these smarter adversaries like bankers and rogue traders and such to enable them to commit these really much more sophisticated crimes. Like if I know that I can gain access to a terminal that has the Swift application on it, then I know that I can gain credentials to the entitled user. I know that I don't have to try to breach the Swift network because the soft underbelly is the computer in a bank, perhaps in Bangladesh or Vietnam or somewhere, that has that installed application, and I can just use that access with my banker's knowledge to then manipulate funds transfers. So what it means is, yes and no to your prior question, yes, we have to change the way we think about cybercrime. We have to think about the objectives and not so much about the indicators. But no, we have to still shore up these defenses. These botnets haven't emerged overnight. They've been growing for more than a decade. And so blacklisting of IPs, while it has declining value because the use of advanced techniques, there is still some value. The use of signatures in malware detection also have declining value, but there's still some value. And so we can't afford to discard the tools that we've invested in, the growth and adoption of over the past 20 years. We have to continue to use those, but we need to pursue more advanced technology that help us stay ahead of the advancing methods that are being used by hackers.
It sounds like, and I'm totally with you on the signature-based technologies and the traditional technologies. The one thing that we see is, even if they're only stopping, 60%, that's 60% you don't have to worry about. So, that definitely makes sense to me. But
there's a more important concept there as well. So part of this third wave is that often the malware that's recognizable that gets dropped into an environment is related to advanced persistent threat activities that have other objectives. And so I'll commonly find things like adware or ransomware or other things dropped into an environment that are recognizable by signature-based technologies, whether it be host intrusion, network intrusion, or antivirus technologies. They're readily recognizable. And that's become a tactic that these cyber criminals have been leveraging in this third wave of activity, where they treat technology as a distraction today as well, because they know that these recognizable alerts will distract responders and get them to chase what I call the fire in the high school so that they can focus on robbing the jewelry store.
Right.
And that we're seeing more and more of that occurring.
So from your perspective, what's the most valuable data that attackers are looking for now? We went through a period where there were these massive attacks, sort of looking for customer lists and personal information, and then we heard a lot about the attacker looking for credentials so that they could log on to systems, more looking for passwords and that sort of thing. And then there's been a lot of discussion around IP, intellectual property, and the sort of crown jewels that the company has. Do you see any particular direction that criminals are looking these days in terms of what the most valuable data that they can possibly get might be?
Yeah, and it's a basic principle. So with the growth of this cybercrime economy, they've created organizations that they have to fund and they have to maintain, much like any kind of company. And what that means is that they've got to maintain access primarily and grow that access into new targets and expand into new environments so that they've always got something to offer that they can recoup funds from their marketing to subscribers or other types of consumers. So the most valuable data today that attackers are looking for coincidentally remains credentials. So that's why we continue to see targeted phishing. We continue to see spam campaigns. We continue to see adware, which all of those three categories, by the way, share their roots in certain types of malware that are fundamentally botnets, independent of what they offer on the front end. On the back end, they're still botnets subscribing hosts that will correspond their configuration information back to a bot master, who will then make determinations on what to do with those hosts that they've gained information about. The most valuable data today that attackers are after, and I'm talking about attackers, is credentials and access. Now, the most valuable data that cyber criminals are after And those are the sophisticated adversaries that are intent on either disrupting an election process or manipulating the SWIFT network or stealing opportunities to trade in the over-the-counter commodities markets. That's different. That's really by the objectives that they have and ultimately by the timing. But they're not really attackers. They're subscribers to attackers' networks.
Right. Got it. Okay. I wanted to ask you, as the technology evolves, one of the things that we're seeing are a series of tools and services around the dark web or the deep web, kind of designed to help enterprises find information about themselves on the dark web or to use information that's on the dark web to help build their defenses. What's your sense about how much time an IT professional, a security professional, should spend, you know, doing that sort of research? Should today's IT professional be spending more time investigating what's on the dark web, or is that a rat hole that takes more time than it's worth?
No, they absolutely should. So for the past 4 or 5 months, I've been completing a commission for Trend Micro, which is a cyber investigation body of knowledge. It's kind of like a program manager's guide, where I borrowed a page from my friends Stu McClure and Joel Scambra and George Kurtz's book, Hacking Exposed. And rather than write it myself, I put together leading lawyers, FBI agents, other law enforcement, as well as private industry cybersecurity experts who each contributed certain domain knowledge. And in that, we particularly discussed the emerging need for the organization of cyber investigations capabilities in companies. And one of those really fundamental requirements that's different today than it was even 10 years ago is an intelligence function. It's really important that organizations that have intellectual property, whether it be financial or truly knowledge capital, it's really important that they be at least aware as attackers can be about the footprint and the information that's accessible about their organization on the internet. And so it's important to have someone in an organization tasked with intelligence collection. And the attackers use the dark web. They also use the light web, and they use the deep web. Each of those are different concepts, of course. And so too should organizations that really want to adapt their thinking and their defenses to combat the types of attacks and APT that affects them today.
Thank you. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, we all want to know more about how the criminal's acting, but we're so busy fighting fires and you know, just dealing with the basic issues of things like compliance and regulatory requirements and that sort of thing. And it's hard to get to all of these things. Do you think that we will see, you know, more automation and more intelligence being collected in a way that enterprises can harvest it without having to do it themselves?
Yes, and it's interesting you mention this issue. So there is a coincidental capability that can help an organization comprehend what actors are doing and how they do it, as well as help them address their compliance regulatory reporting needs and to improve their own defenses. And that's what we call red teaming. The organizations and the individuals who have training and red teaming capabilities are practicing practically the same tactics and the same techniques that actors or that the cyber criminals are using. And part of that practice is they're also collecting this type of intelligence from the deep and the dark web, as well as the light web, to understand the vulnerabilities that an organization has. both technical as well as procedural and human vulnerabilities. So red teaming is a really important activity in today's defensive posture. And it's both a good practice to have the capability internally as well as to support periodic external red teaming exercise.
Well, this is great, Shane, and I really appreciate the time that you've spent with us today. We reached the bottom of the hour, and I could ask a whole bunch more questions, but unfortunately we're out of time. We're gonna do what we can to see if we can move the audience to our chat function, where hopefully we'll be able to get Shane online and able to answer a few more questions. But I wanted to thank you very much for being here, and Sarah, we'll let you kind of wrap things up here for us.
Thank you, Tim and Shane, and thank you to all of you who joined us today. If you missed any of today's episode, don't fret, because the archived version will be available right here in just moments. And please join us next month for our next episode of Dark Reading Radio on October 19th, when we tackle the perpetually pesky topic of the cyber skills shortage. That is, again, on October 19th. Now, for Shane Shook, Tim Wilson, and everyone here at Dark Reading, I'm Sarah Peters. We'll see you next time.